So this is Whiskey and IR Theory. It's a podcast featuring Dan Nexon, that's me, and Patrick Jackson, whose dulcet voice you'll be hearing soon enough. What we do on this podcast is we choose a work of international relations scholarship. Usually it's something classic. Sometimes, you know, it's just whatever strikes our fancy. Then we pair it with a thematically appropriate whiskey. We talk about that work. We drink some whiskey. We talk about that work some more. We drink some more whiskey. We continue to talk about that work, and we drink even still yet more whiskey until hopefully we've got something which has a modicum of educational or at least entertainment value. And that's kind of all there is to it. So without further ado, let's get this thing started. So we're discussing Ann Tichenor's You Just Don't Understand, Troubled Engagements Between Feminists and IR Theorists, which was published in 1997. So you know Ann fairly well, all things considered. Now she's a colleague of yours.
And when we used to go into offices, then her office is actually right across the hall from me, which is great. So
you always do the biography, but maybe you should definitely do the biography.
I can definitely do the biography. So J. Ann Tichenor, her first name is actually Judith, but she does not use it in a professional context, so Ann Tichenor. But everything she's published is under J. Ann Tichenor. She's born 1937 and received her PhD from Brandeis in 1983, where her supervisor was none other than Robert Cohen, which will become tremendously important for this article, but for a variety of other things as well. She taught for a number of years at the University of Southern California. She taught at Brown. She was a visiting adjunct professor at the Watson Institute there. She has a number of different distinguished scholar-in-residence and visiting professorships all over the world. I'm glancing at her CV at the moment, and that the list of research positions that she has held takes up a full page in her CV. So she has been around quite a bit. Something that will become relevant for the whiskey selection in a moment is that she was a visiting professor at Monash University in Australia for a number of years. And when she first came to AU, she actually split her time, where about half the year she would be at American and half the year she would be in Australia, and was going back and forth regularly between those as she was working on this project on indigenous IR, which is the thing that has been occupying her for the last several years. She is, I think it's fair to say, one of the key IR feminist scholars of the 20th century. Clearly someone who, both in her work and in her mentoring and training of various people, had a huge impact in bringing feminist theory into the study of international affairs. Her list of students is quite voluminous in terms of the number of people that she has reached, but also books that she has written on feminist approaches to security have been important touchstones for people over the years. And her essays in particular often get read and cited and assigned. So a lot of people, I know myself, my first exposure to my very first exposure to feminist IR was the Cynthia Enloe stuff that we have done a previous podcast on. But in grad school, the first thing I remember reading was this piece. So the first sort of piece that really brought feminist IR theory to the foreground was this. And I've been very fortunate over the years to have interacted with Anne, collaborated with her on a number of things. One of the what I think will probably be the high points of my whole career is that I got to co-teach a class with her twice at AU, a PhD class, which we called Advanced International Relations Theory, the unpublished subtitle being All the Stuff You Should Have Read But You Didn't Because Nobody Assigned It. So it was a lot of contemporary explorations of the margins of IR theory. And the way we had set it up was we had visiting scholars basically either fly in or zoom in to be able to talk to folks. able to draw on Anne's very extensive network. So when we were talking about feminist philosophy and we were reading Sandra Harding on objectivity, Anne called up her friend Sandra, and then Sandra Harding zoomed in and was able to chat with the class for an hour or so, which was just fantastic. We were working from an old syllabus of Haywood Alker's, and then we updated it in certain ways to bring up some things that happened after Alker's death in 2007. So, by the way, for people who don't know, Anne Techner was married to Haywood Alker, and they are, as far as I know, the only husband and wife team that have ever both been presidents of the International Studies Association. Haywood was president, and Anne has also been the president of the International Studies Association. So, tremendously important figure, important thinker, important scholar, important mentor.
That's a great intro, but got to do the really important thing,
right,
now, which is you're going to tell us about the whiskey that I can only look at on a computer screen.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. So, unfortunately, I don't have any actual whiskey from the Monash area, New South Wales.
But you have a Tasmanian,
but I do have Tasmanian.
Then? Is that it?
So, this is a Hellier's Road single malt, which was actually given to me, a gift that was given to me by Kai Wilkinson when we were doing a thing together in Europe a couple of years ago. And Kai brought me a little tasting bottle of some of this stuff, which is fantastic. I have not opened this particular one. I have had some of the other things in that particular tasting, but this is the peated one right here. So it is Hellier's Road Tasmanian Distillery Peated Single Malt Whiskey, made in Burnie, Tasmania. And so that, in honor of the fact that Anne had spent so much time down in Australia, I figured Australian, it was a good excuse to break open the Australian whiskey. So.
So just so you know, this is
our big oogie. Yum.
I finished out a couple of bottles since the last time we did
this.
Yeah,
so. Well, that happened.
I have to say, I really like Tasmanians, mm-hmm. and unlike you, I like both the non-peated and the mm-hmm. peated varieties. Mm-hmm. They're really hard to find.
They are. Yeah, I've not been able to find any. You know, I picked up a bottle of something when I was in Australia a year ago, so I still have that. But this is the stuff that Kai brought me, and so I figured this is what we would bring out.
All right, so
cheers. Oh, that's good. Oh, I like that.
So, is it have that kind of the real smoothness I associate then with a peated
kind of peated overlay, and then it's got a really long finish. Oh, I like that. And it's not sweet.
It's not sweet.
So, you know, it's keeps its complexity all the way through. Yum.
Okay, so when it comes down to it, the reason for this wine selection is simply Australia. You couldn't say anything about the quality of the scotch that reminded you of Anne in any way.
Well, that's a good question. Let me think about that for a second. The thing that's interesting about this is that it lingers. The finish goes on for quite a while, which is quite interesting. And my experience with Anne over the years is that she will say things and then they kind of resonate around in my head a little while. And okay. So there are levels and layers of complexity that show up. And it's interesting because I think if one approaches Anne Techner's work too quickly, then you miss how path-breaking it is. Because she does a lot of summarizing. She does a lot of pulling together of other people's stuff. She does a lot of, in this piece, right, she does a lot of platforming of people who now we think of as just household names in feminist IR. And part of why they're feminist household names in feminist IR outside of just feminist circles is because of the activity of people like Anne in pulling them together and saying, no, these are the people you need to read. I know in one of the earlier parts, I don't know if we got this on tape, but you suggested that in some ways this is kind of a feminist primer. And it is. And I think that's an important contribution that it makes. It's a really good feminism in IR 101 for people who perhaps have only read the dismissals, and I'm going to put that in air quotes, because they're dismissals that sometimes come in the guise of toleration and acceptance, but dismissals of the radicality of feminist thought by trying to bring them into a more mainstream project. And Anne politely says in this piece to her former dissertation advisor, no, that's not what we're about. That's not what feminism is about. That's not what feminist IR is about. This is not simply adding a gender gloss to existing ways of doing things. Now, if you're looking for some profound statement of feminist originality, that's not what Anne is doing here. So you could say, oh, this is just something you would assign to your undergrads or something if they wanted like the three talking points about feminism. And okay, there is some of that, but it is to a much more profound purpose in a re-envisioning of what it is that the field might be able to do. I remember when I first wrote Conduct of Inquiry and they sent it, one of the people I wanted them to send it to for a possible endorsement was Anne. And in addition to putting an endorsement on it, she also sent me a very nice note in which she highlighted the ways that some of the stuff that I was doing in that book was an expansion in more explicitly philosophical language of the kind of engagement she herself had been calling for decades. So there was a very nice element of connection there. And I really deeply appreciated that, recognizing how the project that she was engaged in seemed simple on the surface, but was a much more powerful project about changing the character of what it is we do in IR.
Yeah, I always wonder, I don't trust my reaction to pieces like this, and I don't trust it for two reasons. The first is, like, I am a dilettante in feminist theory, but I did take multiple women's studies courses in college. So compared to, I think, your average, like, middle-aged white dude who does security, this stuff is not that unfamiliar to me. Like, you know, I recognize some of the names, for example, in here that she who are outside of IR who she's bringing in and citing. And secondly, because the position, and I think this is part of what you're alluding to, the positioning of feminism within, she uses the positivist, post-positivist framework to discuss it. But the kind of epistemological positioning here is not at all, I mean, I think to us it's not very surprising looking in 2020, but I don't know what that means in 1997. That I don't know what it would be like to read this, for example, if I were somebody who did very mainstream international relations in the 90s, had been doing it for a while, was the kind of person who thought, well, there are these people doing feminist, they call themselves doing feminist IR, and I guess that's okay, maybe. Some of the things they study, I don't really recognize. You know, whatever. You know, I don't know what my reaction to reading this would have been from that perspective. Or if I were somebody who was maybe more critically inclined, but was mostly doing post-structural work that was not gender sensitive. Or if I was doing mostly, you know, Marxist inflected work that was really not gender sensitive, that was much more class oriented or talking about, you know, hegemonic blocks or what have you, whether this for me would then be a really good piece to orient my thinking or a way of saying, aha, okay, I understand better now what feminist IR is up to. And I understand where this might fit into my view of the discipline or my kind of project, or in particular thinking about, you know, well, the way in which the positioning of feminism with post-positive and critical work creates a series of coalitions and alliances, and I don't know to what degree those existed, right, in the time. Now, in a post-intersectional world, or in a world where we think about, you know, nth wave feminism and we think about the problem of race and gender, something she name checks here actually. You know, I don't know if those kinds of alliances felt more natural, or you know, sort of whether our concern about one sort of categorical identity was supposed to lead us to concerns about other kinds of categorical identities, their interaction. I don't know whether that was at all typical at the time. So I had a lot of trouble. I mean, I thought it was a great piece, but I had a lot of trouble evaluating what she was up to. And so I'm really glad that you're here to help me think through it.
Well, that's why two heads are better than one for these things, so we can bounce off of each other. It seems to me that in order to really put this piece in context, like, we've got to talk about two other pieces, or at least mention them briefly. One of them, I think we've already done out on the podcast before. I think that if you to put the standard 2-3 years behind this, this comes out in 90, when is this piece? This is 97, which means that the piece, she's thinking about writing it in 94, 95. And I don't think you could do mainstream US-centric IR in 94, 95 without thinking about Wet 92. And the kind of coalition, the kind of alliance that Wet was very explicitly proposing between certain strains of constructivist approach, constructivist scholarship, constructivist theory, and certain strains of liberal theory.
And right, strong liberalism. Right.
And Tichenor then coming along with this by explicitly connecting feminist interventions to more critical kinds of approaches. There's a little bit of a, I think, an implied rebuff of Wendt's Via Media. Because, and this is the thing that, honestly, that I took, and I didn't take it the first time I read it, but I certainly took it when I was rereading some feminist work for writing the sixth chapter of Conduct of Inquiry. The way that Anne very deliberately wanted to say, there are differences, and we should understand and respect those differences, but that doesn't mean that we should split up and go our own way. So a kind of engaged pluralism, as Joseph Lapid would then later call it, is very much what she's going for here. And I think in context, we have to read that as being a bit of a dialogue with Wendt's Via Media, which was based much less on preserving the tension between important differences and much more on where are points of commonality that we can then agree on and move forward. So that's one of the two touchstones. The other one, the very explicit one, is the Cohane 1989 piece that she's directly linking her intervention to, that she's directly responding to. Now, you read the Cohane piece for this as well, right?
Mm-hmm.
You want to talk a little bit about just what that was and what Cohane was doing in there?
Now, you're so much better at summarizing these things than I am. This was, this is the thing. So maybe I glanced through this in a weird way, but I had thought, for some reason, I had thought this was the presidential address.
Cohane's piece?
Right. Or,
No, the presidential address is the two the International Institutions, Two Approaches. That's the 88 piece.
Ah, I read the wrong piece.
Oh, okay. Okay, because she is so, sort of responding to that, but the one she's directly responding to is the 1989 Millennium piece.
Okay, so yeah, because I was looking through this and I was like, there's nothing about feminism here. There's none of the stuff I remember, like, that Bob Cohane did that pissed off the feminists. Obviously, I remembered enough of it that I was like, oh, right, I can see exactly what she's doing with the Kant stuff there. Among people who do critical work, the Millennium piece is infamous and not in a good way. So I was very confused looking through this and thinking, this is not what I remembered, but that explains a great deal. So maybe you should talk about, definitely you should talk about the whole Millennium.
Got it.
Talk about the
Got
piece.
Got it. So Cohane he's president of the International Studies Association. He does the presidential address that you were just mentioning, which is that 88 piece, the two approaches to international institutions, which really doesn't mention, not only doesn't mention feminism, but doesn't mention an awful lot of critical scholarship in any great detail, and so lumps them all into this one box called reflectivism, and then juxtaposes it to rationalism. And it's interesting because the direct response to that piece that I always love is a piece that Hayward Alker wrote, which is called Rescuing Reason from the Rationalists, in which he had the subtitle. Hayward had the best subtitle. So the subtitle of the piece is something like Reading Vico, Marx, and Weber as Reflective Institutionalists. It's hysterical. But again, it appeared in Millennium, which I think is not incidental, because Millennium, in that time period especially, was one of the peak places for critical IR scholarship to appear. And Cohen, by writing a piece that then appeared in Millennium, is clearly speaking outside of his normal audience. It's not the same people who would be reading a Presidential Address in International Studies Quarterly, necessarily. It is a different space. And I think it's important to note that one of the reasons why Anne, in the article, says that she's picking up on this is because what Bob Cohen did was attempt to reach out, an attempt to engage. So she cites Cohen several times as being one of those scholars who is at least attempting to take feminist work seriously. But from there, Tickner is not real pleased with what Cohen does. Because Cohen's piece, if I just do the brief summary of it, Cohen introduces three different categories of three different kinds of feminism that he says you can see floating around in international relations. You have empirical feminism, you have standpoint feminism, and you have postmodern feminism. These are all Cohen's labels. And basically what Cohen says is empirical feminism is just giving us some new cases to do the same sort of standard thing to. Standpoint feminism is about maybe rethinking some of our concepts to make them less androcentric so we can have a different definition of power, an expanded definition of power, say, that involves cooperative activity and not just coercion. That's one of the examples that he uses. But postmodern feminism is evil and no one should do it. Because postmodern feminism, for Cohen, is the relativist abandonment of all scientific standard and throwing everything out, and it's the kind of hand-wringing hysteria that you see all over a book like King, Cohen, and Verba's Designing Social Inquiry. And the category is postmodern. That's the bad thing. That's what we should not be doing. So that's basically what Cohen argues in this 1989 piece. Now, there are a variety of reactions to this piece that reverberate through feminist IR for a good decade, couple of decades even. So, you know, when Cindy Weber is writing about good girls and bad girls, then that's one of the touchstones, is this particular division that Cohen came up with. But what Tickner does in her response, which I think is absolutely brilliant, is she takes all three of the categories that Cohen introduces and she sort of transforms them. So she keeps those three categories, but says, well, actually, we really need to tweak them and do something a little bit different with them. And if you do that, then this becomes a much more productive engagement. So she takes what Cohen offers as if it were an opening to dialogue. But I think she signals pretty clearly in even the title of the piece that she's very realistic about exactly how far this dialogue is going to go. That there's an opening here for a dialogue, but not on the terms that Cohen has set down, because in the terms that Cohen has set down, feminism doesn't really have much to bring to the table. It has to fit into a set of mostly methodological concerns about research programs and hypothesis testing and so on, and misses a lot of what the feminist project is actually about. So what Tickner does is not just say Cohen attacked feminism in the guise of offering an olive branch. Instead, she says, Cohen wants to have a discussion. That's great. He should be commended for wanting to have a discussion. But the terms of the discussion, let's revisit them a little bit. So it's a kind of a gentle approach to producing a dialogue. But the structure of that whole first part of Tickner's article is just a mirror image of Cohen's three categories. So
to do this, she draws her title from Deborah Tannen's work in a really well-known, very popular, widely read work of popular linguistics. Tannen's essential argument, as Ann Tickner talks about it, is that gendered styles of communication are quite distinctive, and therefore that men who perform as men and women who perform as women adopt different cultures of communication. And those cultures of communication are distinctive enough that it should be understood like cross-cultural communication. You know, cishet man and cishet woman sit down over breakfast, that they will have the kinds of barriers and miscommunications that we would normally expect to see in the domain of people from two very distinctive societies or cultures talking to one another. And one of the obvious kinds of takeaways from this sort of analysis has to do with power relations and the idea, for example, that masculine modes of communication are privileged, are generally treated as superior, more authoritative, and you can get fairly straightforward arguments about the association of the gender binary with men with strength, rationality, cold logic, women with care and comfort, and even in some tellings of irrationality, emotionalism. And by situating her argument around this analogy, where it's not even an analogy, it's an argument essentially that what Tannen is describing in standard interpersonal male-female communication occurs in interpersonal male-female communication and feminist-non-feminist communication in the field. And this is, I think, a fairly important move, because it's a move that immediately situates the question of where feminist IR fits within IR as a question that is not simply about abstract ideas, but it's a question that's about the actual practices of people on panels in scholarly societies like the International Studies Association, and in peer review settings and other kinds of settings, that says that those practices themselves are already structured by gender in a way that is theoretically accessible through feminist theory in the same way that other aspects of international politics are accessible through feminist theory. And this is both an important move in terms of taking on a set of distinctions that Cohen wants to draw and arguing that they reflect a kind of gender politics. And it's also an important distinction in terms of immediately making it difficult to escape if you buy this argument, which I think is attractive to a lot of people. People who don't even think of themselves as feminists would recognize the kind of Tannen argument. It's essentially an ethnographic argument. It looks at practices of people. Nonetheless, I think that it's a really interesting move to set up the argument, and it does this multiple levels of work.
I agree. I think that in a way, she's riffing on the kind of two cultures notion that you've got in natural sciences and the humanities. There is a whole series of sociology of scientific communication things that are kind of lurking in the background of this. The way she wants to cut into it is obviously using Tannen. But what I think is interesting here is that Tannen, you said metaphor before and you kind of backed off of it. In a way, Tannen is a metaphor for her. She's not really doing Deborah Tannen's style analysis.
Well, I said analogy, and the reason I backed off is it's not an analogy, it's a metaphor.
Okay. Yes, it is. It is really yes, that's exactly what it is. It's a metaphor for the ways in which communication fails between feminist and non-feminist IR scholars. And fails not because of particular people's mistakes, but because of something systematic about the different ways that feminist and non-feminist scholars, broadly speaking, come at these things. And what's fascinating about this is she demonstrates this by taking those exact three categories of Cohen's and showing how, from a feminist perspective, again, broadly construed, those three categories appear different. So Cohen's empirical feminism, which is simply about looking at women and you have basically more cases that you can do things with,
You add gender or you add sex and use.
Exactly, exactly. Right. And you don't stir it that much. It's just adding in another independent variable, basically. But Tickner points out that if we take seriously the feminist understanding of gender, bottom of page 614, she gives kind of the standard definition, right? Set of variable but socially and culturally constructed characteristics such as power, autonomy, rationality, and public that are stereotypically associated with masculinity and their opposites, weakness, dependence, emotion, and private are associated with femininity, and that these depend on each other. So there's male and female coding, masculine, feminine coding, and then there's a hierarchy, right? Standard kind of stuff if one reads any feminist theory. But that using that definition, then empirical feminism can't simply be about, well, adding in some women as another case or as another variable. Instead, it's about the gendered social relations that we find and how those constrain and enable different forms of action. Which is to say, gender isn't about women necessarily. And that is not something that Cohen envisions in his category, because Cohen's category says, oh, well, we're just describing the empirical marginalization of women. And Tickner says, actually, no, from a feminist point of view, it's not just about describing the marginalization of women. It is about exposing gendered social relations. So,
yeah, and on 615, she closes out this paragraph that begins by quoting Joan Scott by saying recent feminist writings that deal with issues of race and class problematize these power relationships still further.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. And that fades off into Cohen's second category, right? Cohen's second category, standpoint feminism. And for Cohen, this is simply about changing the concepts that we operate with. So we can essentially modify our definitions of certain things, and then we go out and sort of do standard social science to them. And what Tickner points out is that actually what's at stake here, this is underscoring something that you said earlier, what's at stake here is nothing less than the boundaries of what counts as IR. That if we really take seriously that there is such a thing as a feminist standpoint, then we have to rethink what goes in the box of international studies scholarship. What kinds of things count as legitimate targets of security? What does it mean to say there is such a thing as the legitimate exercise of power? That we need to rethink these core IR topics. We can't simply hold on to them and say, well, we'll just kind of, you know, gender them up a little bit. No, there's a much more fundamental shift in what constitutes the boundaries of the field if you really take that seriously.
Yeah, and then before we get there, although it's related, the other move she makes here is not simply to say that feminism, in a sense, and this is part of the point she drives home, that feminist scholarship has this epistemological content that makes it distinctive. Again, the metaphor of ways of seeing or ways of speaking. And it's not just concerned with women, it's concerned with constitutive power relationships. But she also then points out something that, again, from 2020, yeah, might seem fairly obvious. And I think it says something about the mid-90s, I guess, in IR, that she says that feminism is not about women, per se. I mean, it is, feminist scholarship is often concerned with women, but gender is not, as she says here, therefore, gender is not just about women, it is also about men and masculinity, a point that needs to be emphasized if scholars of international relations are to better understand why feminists claim that is relevant to their discipline and why they believe that a gendered analysis of its basic assumptions and concepts can yield fruitful results.
Exactly. And part of why that now appears to people like us as fairly obvious is because of pieces like this and the work that people like Tickner did to bring those concerns in. And to bring those concerns in, to bring those concerns into a more mainstream English-speaking debate. You can imagine a different counterfactual trajectory here where feminist IR gets annoyed about the horrible treatment that feminist scholarship was getting from a lot of the IR mainstream in the 1980s and early 1990s, and said, okay, fine, we're just going to kind of go our own way. And if that had happened, then maybe these things that we now think of as, oh, pretty standard, they wouldn't be standard necessarily. there's an important benefit to the kind of engagement that Tickner was trying to do here to introduce these things, so that now we can look at this and say, oh, well, of course. Well, now we can. But we only can because the trajectory that was followed was this engagement trajectory, rather than a more of an archipelago kind of strategy where it's like we're just going to go off and do our own thing.
But this is, this is something that I was trying to underscore earlier, probably ham-handedly, but the difference between a retrospective reading and a prospective reading. But it's very difficult to do a reading of an older work prospectively. You have to, to some degree, particularly, I mean, we talk about this as if, we live this, but this was only 2 years after I was in grad school, and 3 years after you were in grad school, we were not really in the discipline in any full way at this point. The reason I emphasize that is that, we may feel like we're middle-aged men who have been around for a while, but I don't actually have a very good sense of what it would be like to read this prospectively in 1997.
Yeah.
Therefore, I worry about anything that I say is going to be more treating it as a part of the archive. Mm-hmm. I want to be clear that anything I say along these lines is likely to be a reconstruction of what things must have been like for this intervention to have been necessary and to play out the way that it did. But I can't speak to what things were actually like. And I don't think you can really either, except for you have maybe a little bit more hearsay from Anne herself, and we've had our conversations with people from our generation who do feminist scholarship, who had a much more close encounter, so to speak, with the kinds of power dynamics that Anne is talking about here. Although I will say that there is the other aspect of that, which is that arguments that are successful always seem obvious in retrospect. I think I may have mentioned this before in the podcast, but it is not infrequent for me in my seminars to have somebody say, well, I like this book, but I thought it was fairly intuitive. And, I will say, well, was it intuitive before you read it or after you read it?
Yeah.
And the best arguments feel intuitive after the draft. Then moves into a discussion about how Tannen claims that women are more comfortable than men with an ethnographic style of individually oriented storytelling typical of anthropology, a difference that fits IR scholarship as well. Again, if it's scalable, if it's feminist analysis all the way down, then what we get here now is a fairly, I think, convincing move where she just basically has now pivoted to the claim that essentially in dismissing certain kinds of work, you are engaged in anti-feminist politics, which of course you don't want to be in because you consider yourself a feminist. You've said so explicitly.
Right. And she deliberately and explicitly connects that to what she calls epistemological, and I would tend to think we should probably more understand as methodological sets of constraints. So that the what...
Have you ever explained that difference in this podcast?
Have I? I don't know if I have.
I don't think you have. So
should
you need
I explain
to explain
that?
What you mean
okay.
by that.
Okay.
Yeah, you do.
Okay.
You need to explain.
So let me explain. There are two different construals of the term epistemology or epistemological that you can find floating around in a lot of the philosophical discussions of these matters. There is the narrow definition of epistemology, which is concerned with how one crosses the Cartesian mind-world gap to make sure that our conjectures about reality actually line up to the nature of reality, which is where we get falsification and hypothesis testing and so on and so forth from. And then in that sense, a lot of epistemological discussion is about the best ways of doing that, ensuring that we're able to cross that mind-world gap and produce correspondence between our conjectures and the actuality of things. And then there's the broader understanding of epistemology, which is just more generally concerned with the status of knowledge and what it means to know things. The reason I tend not to like the language of epistemology is that it very often gets pulled into that first category. And so, oh, there's an epistemological difference here becomes essentially a technical question about how exactly we ensure that our hypothetical conjectures are being appropriately verified or falsified. as opposed to what I believe Tickner and others are doing with the notion of epistemology, which is pulling it in a much broader direction. The flag in here is the fact that she draws on Stephen Toulmin. And Stephen Toulmin...
That was interesting, I thought.
Well, there's two parts of that. Part of that is personal, because at the time she's drawing on, on Toulmin, Toulmin is the dean of the School of International Relations at USC and was co-teaching classes with Hayward, to which Anne would often go. And they would all, it was sort of an intellectual communion of minds. I mean, God, to be a fly on the wall in that seminar with the three of them, whew, wow. And then occasionally Nick Onuf would show up, and it's like, oh my goodness, there you go. There's your you know, super group, IR rock band or something. But she's drawing on Toulmin, but the other thing that's important about drawing on Toulmin is, and particularly what she's drawing on, if you look at what she's actually citing from Toulmin, so what she's citing is not Toulmin's more technical work on argumentation, but she's citing Toulmin's 1990 book, Cosmopolis. And Toulmin's whole project in that book, right, is to say, we have construed the Enlightenment in these narrowly Cartesian terms about rational progress and individual subjects, and there's a whole other part of the Enlightenment, a more skeptical tradition that comes through Montaigne and other sorts of things, and if we examine the Enlightenment project in that way, then we can both critique the way that modernity has unfolded and maybe start to envision another one. And it's not an accident that I use a quote from Toulmin as one of the epigraphs for Conduct of Inquiry, because where Toulmin wants to go is a more pluralistic understanding of what it would possibly mean to know things. So to break out of the Cartesian constraints on epistemology. So part of why I get allergic to the word epistemology is precisely because it gets pulled into that narrower version. And to say, oh, well, we're talking about epistemological issues here, that could easily be misheard as, oh, we're talking about technical questions about hypothesis validation. No, that's not what I mean. I don't think that's what Tickner means by it. So I would say that when she's talking about epistemology here, she's really talking about methodology, the broader question of, like, how do you construct knowledge that is in some sense valid? And that production of knowledge does not always necessitate some kind of hypothesis testing exercise, which is, of course, precisely her critique of Cohen's version, his dismissal of postmodern feminism, is basically that feminists don't have testable hypotheses, so they've abandoned all scientific standards. And Tickner says, no, theory is broader than you think it is. And methodology is broader than you think it is. One of the things that, and she said this in print as well as to me individually, one of the things she really liked about Conduct of Inquiry is precisely that I was playing around in that same space of methodology and trying to give language for, like, how we could talk about what these differences actually were. And she's drawing on Sandra Harding, and Sandra Harding plays around in that space too. So there's a number of people who are doing this. So ultimately, this is not just about the word, right? You want to use the word epistemology, fine, use the word epistemology. But if we do, we have to remember that what Tickner means is something much broader than this kind of narrow Cartesian thing about knowing subjects in a world that has to be mirrored. So that's the critique that basically she says, because feminists tend to be more sympathetic to these other modes of knowledge production, insisting that good feminist scholarship fit into these neo-positivist strictures of good social science is a form of marginalization and should not be pursued.
I have a cat who is, I think, angling to check out my whiskey.
Oh, excellent.
And maybe the monitor. Okay. And will eventually decide that she needs to be in my lap. So if I'm looking a little wary, here she comes. Here she comes. Yep. Yep, onto my lap. There she
Who
is.
Do we have this?
Hey,
Kibbeth. Okay. Excellent. Excellent.
So, but here she's just using epistemology in the sense of the question of how do we know things.
Right. It's that broad sense.
And the idea here is that a lot of feminist scholarship, and the ones that, particularly the kinds of feminist scholarship that she is drawing on, have understandings of how knowledge comes about and is produced that are inconsistent with a kind of naive empiricism or a kind of flat-footed positivism. This, I mean, is complicated. We, I think, have touched on this before. It relates back to your book, but what we're calling positivism and post-positivism and this kind of stuff is just not aligned very well with what you would talk about in philosophy of science. So in philosophy of science, Popper is not a positivist. Lakatos is not a positivist. Nope. These are all people who are in the post-positivists. But in international relations speak, positivism is associated with a kind of hodgepodge of nomothetical generalization, empiricism, hypothesis testing, stuff that's actually quite influenced not simply by, you know, Carnap and earlier logical empiricists, but also by Popper and Lakatos and people we think of as post-positivists. So it's very difficult to translate this outside of the field sometimes, although I think this is not atypical of the social sciences more broadly. That being said, what she's doing in essence is arguing that a feminist perspective immediately starts raising questions about the basis of the production of knowledge as being non-neutral, as being gendered. And necessarily, though, then when you say, why can't you just do our thing? And if you're not doing our thing, then you're not legitimate. You're engaging in gender politics. And again, you're hoisted by your own petard, in a sense, because most of the people she's arguing with would conceive of themselves with and do conceive of themselves as feminist.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so on 623, just to drive the point home. So in 623, and she says, well, you know, feminist theories might fit more comfortably into what Hollis and Smith term inside or hermeneutical approach. Feminists construct their knowledge about international relations not so much from the perspective of insiders, but from the voices of the disempowered and the marginalized not previously heard. So there are two different levels or two different aspects of this. There's insiderness in the sort of hermeneutic sense, but then there's also outsiderness, meaning we're not just going to talk about elites. So there is a politics to the production of knowledge for feminist theorists that is not explicitly acknowledged by neopositivists like Cohane, who are simply producing these epistemic standards as if they were neutral and detached and somehow just guaranteed proper access to the real world that actually existed. So holding the political and social relations of knowledge as core to the production of knowledge itself, the kind of position that we would probably really want to call reflexivist, the actual notion that reflexivity is an important component of knowledge production. Which is interesting because, of course, when Cohane divides things up into rationalism and its alternative, the alternative for him is not reflexivism, but reflectivism. So he doesn't even have a category for reflexive knowledge production. And Tickner is one of the people who is very explicit about introducing that as an alternative and giving it that kind of a name. So a lot of the scholarship that then grows up later in terms of the reflexivity of knowledge when suddenly Americans discovered Bourdieu because lots of Europeans had been writing about Bourdieu and using Bourdieu and then suddenly people started reading them. So you have that whole flowering of reflexivity. What's fascinating is that had already been going on in a lot of feminist circles before it showed up from the more Bourdieusian sociology of science kind of approach. A lot of feminists had already gotten there and were already talking in those terms. So, and that to me is a methodological difference. It's just, but what is the status of knowledge and what does it mean to produce knowledge? So that's the radicality of the critique. But as you have said before, just to fork back to something you said earlier or loop back to something you said earlier, it isn't done with an iron fist. It isn't done with a bowling ball. There's no club here, you know, beating you over the head. It's a different kind of style, which is very interesting.
I have no idea, by the way, why I reached for a bowling ball as my heavy weapon of choice. I don't bowl. I would think I would have said a mace, you know, or a sledgehammer, but nonetheless, I don't know, bowling balls. So speaking of things that aren't bowling balls, she also makes the point that feminist theories are not come in many different guises, right? And on 620, again, something that I think if you know feminist theory, you know, but that feminist theory is variously identified as Marxist, radical, psychoanalytic, socialist, standpoint, existentialist, and postmodern, describe the causes and consequences of women's oppression, and prescribe strategies for removing it. Now, the thing here that obviously this is a bit of a, you know, kind of a, well, what's the term I'm looking for? This is kind of a you don't know what you're talking about to some kinds of criticisms, pointing out that feminist theory is far more pluralist and diverse than three categories would allow for. But it's also interesting in the context of this article, which Tichter pivots off of Harding and the emphasis on binaries, right? That is the emphasis on feminine. I think you read the quotation earlier. The analysis is feminism as noticing, denaturalizing, focusing upon the layering on of different kinds of binary distinctions to gender. This is a definitional move. It's a move that motivates some substantive stuff in the argument. We might use terms of a discursive configuration in which gender is mapped onto a series of other kinds of binary distinctions. The binary distinction, though, that she decides to strategically invoke as the basis for cutting up the field is the positivism-post-positivism distinction. And this quotation I just read from 620 is part of this move, I think, this trajectory, this move, this argument that says that no, it's not that they're the postmodernists, the standpointers, and then the nice girls who will let you have a variable to play with. This is the point you made at the outset. She's mapping feminism in a different way onto a different set of distinctions, in one in which feminism becomes a crucial element of a whole set of other theoretical, becomes crucially engaged with, related to, on the side of a whole set of other theoretical traditions that analysis of the type that we just discussed reads it out of, right? Tries to isolate it and treat it as something which is kind of simply its own thing that has no allegiance, or if it has allegiance, it's to essentially a kind of set of methodological perspectives, not to a set of critical emancipatory projects, which is what she's doing here. Is that fair? Am I getting this
right? No, I think you're definitely onto something there. That list of possibilities, theoretical and conceptual traditions of analysis that she's drawing on, is a much richer set than any of our standard IR isms or dichotomies would give us. And in a way, what she's doing in this piece is saying, and this is also where the Deborah Tannen metaphor becomes a really useful thing for her, that we can't simply have, here is IR, and let us then try to slot feminism into it. Instead, it's Women and Men in Conversation, subtitle of Tannen's book. We have two different things, feminism and IR. And yes, we are essentializing by creating the dichotomy and so on and so forth, but it's strategic. But if we don't start with that kind of strategic essentialism, then we can't have anything like a dialogue between the two. Cohane's article isn't about a dialogue between IR and feminism. It's about, here's IR, and here are the little pieces that feminism can fit into. And Tichner's argument doesn't start from IR. Tichner's argument starts from feminism, from the broad swath of feminist thinking, and says there's a lot of feminist work out there, and if you read it, then it speaks to some of the concerns that IR also speaks to, but in a different way. And that right there is a truly radical move for saying that, and I'm going beyond Tichner here a little bit, but thinking about where it appears in International Studies Quarterly, in a way, one could extrapolate from Tickner's piece to say IR is only one way of doing international studies. Like, that's huge, right? That mind blown.
Patrick's making these sort of galaxy brain motions if you know, are just listening to the audio.
Right? But because this is not a possibility that is even envisioned in Cohan's approach, that there would be ways of doing something called international studies that aren't IR. Right? That distinction isn't meaningful for him. So this really helps to expand the definition of what we think international studies might be. Or that's the target here. That's really what she's trying to do, is expand what it means to do international studies such that these things don't have to justify themselves by adopting the methodological or theoretical agendas that are specified by mainstream IR, but instead can say, you know, if you really want to think about security, here are some other aspects of security that we should investigate, and it should be perfectly okay to investigate these things. So interpersonal security should be something we should look at. And if we're looking at wartime rape, to use one of her examples, that shouldn't simply be thought about as a strategic weapon that's being utilized, right? We should be analyzing this in much more phenomenological ways for the experience of gender and so on. So she's really opening up the boundaries or the limits of what counts as legitimate international studies scholarship by doing this, by starting precisely not from IR, but starting from this plethora of things that are going on in feminism more broadly.
She also makes the point that listening to feminists isn't simply about expanding the purview of what constitutes international relations. She also makes the point in a couple of different places that listening to feminists means really rethinking some pretty basic assumptions that run through IR. So, for example, she argues, I think quite convincingly, that the default assumption in IR, following the Westphalian model, a term I hate, but following, you know, sort of the idea of the sovereign state system, is that the state is a source of security. But for women, the state has not been a source of security. The state has been a source of insecurity because the state is often involved in drawing legal distinctions that make women vulnerable to violence, or enforcing more broadly regimes that make women vulnerable to marital rape, to oppression of various sorts, and so on and so forth. And indeed, that the history of state formation is in part a history of the relegation of women to certain spheres, the private sphere, the sphere of not having rights, not having full citizenship, not being political actors. That is a history not of the emancipation of people from the fear of war all against all, but in fact the subjection of certain people to a constant war, you know, in with the WARRE spelling of Hobbes. And here, earlier on, she also makes the argument that state formation, in terms of the development of capitalism within the context of the state, is, in the standard liberal story, the development of property rights is, of course, the development of emancipation, right? People now have rights to their things, which means the state or the aristocrat cannot take it away. You are no longer a serf, for example. But in fact, she points out that process is a process of saying that the people who don't get to participate in the ownership of property, except for under some restricted conditions, are women. And so that process is, again, a process of relative disempowerment. Mm-hmm. And that matters both in terms of the argument about rethinking the standard assumption about the connection between the state and security that underpins not just realist IR, but a lot of state-centric IR. But it also, of course, is then part of this broader attack on why liberalism is not the place where feminists can hang mm-hmm. out. We are not idealists. This is not the way to think about us.
Right, exactly. Like calling attention to the differential consequences of these social arrangements, which we miss if we don't think about the fact that citizen isn't just applied universally to every member of the species Homo sapiens, but is applied to the males, and the women and the children are then subsumed under the male head of household. And if one doesn't have a gendered lens to be able to see this, then you overlook that. You literally don't see it because, no, these sets of relations are not, they become domestic, they become private. We no longer need to treat them as being something political. And granted, you know, these are points that one does not have to necessarily be a feminist to have made these points, but it is certainly the case that feminists pretty much unfailingly make these points and introduce this as something that we absolutely have to grapple with. And in a way that's much more profound than just, oh, well, there's some other aspects to security. No, it really means you got to rethink what it means to have security, and security for whom and by whom.
I mean, I think that what's interesting about this is that what Anne's doing here is taking very standard feminist arguments. I don't mean that in a negative way. They're assumed. We know this thing about the development of the sovereign national state. We know this happened. Renaissance humanism as being an alternative to the Enlightenment, when focused on pluralist uncertainty rather than Enlightenment certainty. And Toulmin, there's actually an interesting thing here that I hadn't thought about. I read Toulmin like back in 1994. Now going back to Toulmin, or thinking about Toulmin after I did work on the Protestant Reformation, the standard way we would talk about the relationship between the Enlightenment and the Protestant Reformation is to say that Protestants mess this up. That Protestants have this account where we move from like the Dark Ages to like the higher Middle Ages, which are kind of like the Dark Ages. And then there's the Renaissance, which is the precursor to the Enlightenment. And it's Protestantism that somehow drives the Enlightenment. Of course, the standard story is this is radically ahistorical, because Protestantism is basically fundamentalism in the period. And so Protestantism, if anything, sets back the cause of scientific rationality. But Toulmin actually is doing something different. Toulmin is saying that actually Protestantism is kind of the Enlightenment, because what the Enlightenment picks up from Protestantism is the drive towards certainty and homogeneity of knowledge and practice that arise from having certainty about Protestantism scripture, but in, you know, as a sort of immutable thing, as opposed to, say, Renaissance humanism, which...
It's also very interesting in light of the exchange between Tickner and Cohen, because, and this is on display in Cohen 88 and 89, the pieces we've already talked about. It's even more on display in the King, Cohen, and Verba book, that approximate certainty, as close to certainty as we can get, is not only the goal, but the only goal that there could be. And other goals don't count as science. So everything is about constraining variation. Everything is about multiplying your n so that you can have the biggest possible evidentiary base to evaluate generalizations. Because that's the most certain you can be. And that position is perfectly compatible with the idea that you're not really going to be able to be certain about very much. But gosh darn it, we can be certain about this, right? So...
Or our goal is certainty.
Exactly.
And anything that contributes in the move towards certainty, anything that gets us more certain knowledge, is better than things that give us more ambiguous knowledge.
Exactly.
Or make us less certain about things.
Where,
except for in the service of breaking down wrong views.
Right. Which is then the real challenge that Tickner is mounting here. To the entire epistemic project of the only goal that is worth pursuing is the goal of increasing certainty. Because instead of increasing certainty, the goal here is to increase multiple perspectives. The goal here is to increase diversity. It's more the Nietzschean notion of objectivity, right? Multiple eyes being able to look at things.
Which is, again, what Toulmin says Renaissance humanism
exactly.
is about. It's about embracing different perspectives. This is a very standard move, right, in feminist criticism, but also in critical theory. She's inverting the binary, right? She's devalorizing the quest for certainty, and she's saying, you know, it's patriarchal, It's problematic. She's doing it, though, in ways that are sort of on your own terms. Say, if you're really committed to a pluralistic field, then this is what pluralism entails, and pluralism entails post-positivist approaches that you might have dismissed as postmodernist or standpoint. Right. Or that she's writing this in response to her advisor, which is a very kind of typical thing to do, right? You slay your advisor or what have you. But it's not the fact that Cohen's essay might be a motivating thing here, or might be the object that around which she structures her reply. We should not beat up on Cohen too much. Cohen is, if anything, more sympathetic towards feminist IR than a lot of people are in the field.
Right. And that's why, to sort of circle back around to where we started, that's why it's important that Cohen makes the overture in the beginning, and that Tickner is arguing sort of demonstratively for accepting that overture as written, and not simply saying, oh, there's a hidden agenda here, and so we shouldn't be trafficking with this. And saying, no, okay, this is great. People want to have a dialogue. So let's have a dialogue. But let's really have a dialogue. So it's an optimistic reading of Cohen, which I think, if we generalize this beyond just Tickner-Cohen, if I want to have if I am on the margins and I want to have a dialogue with the center, then I probably have to read the center's overtures as if they were actually intended to be overtures. I need to give a more sympathetic reading of gestures toward pluralism and say, oh, right, you want to be pluralist. Lovely, let's be pluralist. As opposed to, that clearly isn't what you mean because you actually have this agenda and you really just want to marginalize us. Which is probably true of most mainstreams. But by taking what Cohen did, by taking the gesture in at sort of at face value, I'm not going to say the spirit with which it was intended, but I'm going to say at face value, she constructs Cohen's initiative as the beginning of an actual dialogue. And then the real brilliance of this piece, as we've said, she immediately complicates that by drawing on Deborah Tannen. You want to have a dialogue, but look at the dialogue between men and women. And look how strained that dialogue is because of these different experiences that are encoded in different kinds of language. So you want to have a dialogue. I mean, have you read Tannen at all recently?
Not recently.
Because the one thing that I remember from Tannen is where she ends. And the end is not men and women are separate societies and they should go their own way. It's they continue to be in conversation with each other. Right, the whole end of it is here are different ways in which we can improve communication by understanding the different places from which men and women are operating. And that's the same kind of diagnosis as Tickner is offering. Let's take the dialogue seriously and let's look for ways of having the dialogue better. And in a way, the kind of spiciest that she gets is at the very end of the piece when she's on 629, when she says, well, it may be too easy, it's all too easy to account for these troubled engagements between IR scholars and feminists solely in terms of differences in ontologies and epistemologies. It must be acknowledged that power differences play an important role also. Inequalities in power between mainstream and feminist IR allow for greater ignorance of feminist approaches on the part of the mainstream than is possible for feminists with respect to conventional IR if they are to be accorded any legitimacy within the profession. So, yes, let's have a dialogue, and one of the presuppositions of that dialogue is that we're able to actually engage with each other in some kind of intellectual equality. But let's not lose sight of the fact that there is also this power differential, which is built into the very structures of the profession and built into the hierarchy of ways of producing knowledge. And that kind of internal critique let's take this, let's acknowledge the difference, but then let's also hold open the possibility of there being some kind of a dialogue actually about these epistemological and ontological issues rather than simply a reiteration of power. That's very powerful. That positioning of her stance as being, let's treat these as intellectual issues because it's important for us to treat these as intellectual and conceptual issues, but let's not lose sight of the fact that there is also this power context. And we, as marginalized scholars, and she's speaking at that point to feminist scholars, we have to know more about the mainstream than the mainstream has to know about us. I mean, it's the Du Bois point about double consciousness, right? The margin always understands the center better because the margin has to look at the center and then also kind of understand why it's not the center. But
or it's also the it's also similar to the notion of strategic inconsequibility, mm-hmm. right? You have to talk our language. Anytime that somebody is put in a position of having to explain themselves to you on their terms, that's a power
right.
move.
Right. And that's exactly the space that she wants to play around in here. So it opens up all kinds of interesting possibilities. I mean, bearing in mind your caution about retrospective and prospective readings of this, it's difficult for me reading this now to disentangle this from kind of the trajectory that parts of the field took and the trajectory that then many of us have tried to participate in over the years to push that kind of pluralist dialogue in a particular direction. I have no idea how this would have played for people who were already enshrined as part of that mainstream. But I do know that that project now, I think we have to, if we're tracing that kind of pluralistic dialogue project back, this is one of the important pieces on the road of where that project comes from.
And in IR, so we have a lot more attention to diversity, a lot more attention to the idea that journals need to diversify, need to be more open to different perspectives, less oriented towards imposing standards. We also have a plurality of, you know, many more journals for a variety of reasons, including the International Journal of Feminist, it's the International
Journal of Feminist, Journal Feminist, Feminist Politics? Feminist Studies?
I think
it's IFP. Yeah.
I mean, the one that all our friends have edited and will get angry at us when we don't remember
Hold on,
his name
let me,
properly.
Let me Google.
We've had a lot to
keep
drink
going,
by now.
Keep
That's
going.
My excuse. Yeah. But the... I've completely lost track of what
I was going to say. It's Politics, International Feminist
yes.
Journal of Politics. And yes, many of
politics.
Our friends have edited this.
So what I'm trying to drive at here, which... between the alcohol and the cat on my lap is not being made easy, is that certainly the rhetoric of the field feels more inclusive than it's ever felt. And certainly the idea that editors, for example, have to justify, before you might have had to justify letting in work that wasn't mainstream, right? Now, I still think you have to do that, right, would be my guess. When push comes to shove, there are people who will attack. I mean, journal editors get attacked for everything, but their journal, you know, why did you publish this piece of crap, whatever, posty thing when you wouldn't publish my, you know, scientifically valid piece or what have you. But I think the institutional pressure, at least, is all coming, you know, from on the direction of pluralism. But if you look at the job at hiring market, there's obviously, I think, pluralism in terms of demographics, but in terms of methods, you know, as we become more intellectually committed to pluralism, we've also become less pluralistic in terms of the kinds of scholarship we're producing. And it's a very strange dynamic. It's easier understood if you understand IR as a global right. discipline and where that pluralism is coming from. But nonetheless, it's a little bit weird and it's hard to get a handle of. Because I'd like to say that Anne won, and I think in many ways she did when it came to discourse in the field. And she did not necessarily because this piece caused a victory. You know, we all rallied around and said that's the... But she won because she was on the right side of the trends, and also arguments like this did give legitimacy. It mattered a great deal to publish this kind of work in a journal like ISQ, which was not known for publishing this kind of stuff. nonetheless, right? I mean, it, you know, and she goes on to be president of NSA, right?
Right.
You know,
right.
But nonetheless, I don't know how to assess where we are now, right? I think if you wanted to talk about your ability to get something published that was non-standard in a mainstream journal, it's easier, right? If you want to talk about your ability to get a job doing non-standard work, it's harder.
I think a lot depends on geographically where you're looking. Mm-hmm. Because globally, international studies is a much more pluralistic and diverse place. But there are certainly pockets, some of which are the size of a whole country, some of which are the size of particular departments in particular countries, which are a lot more restricted, right? So you have U.S.-style political science and IR being practiced in some British institutions and some German institutions and so on. And wasn't the last APSR editorial board had, like, they were headquartered in Germany?
It's anchored in Germany, and it was heavily European, and a lot of Americanists were complaining, I think, about the increased distribution of European politics work. But, you know, cry me a river.
And what's interesting about that, of course, is it's, you know, it may have annoyed the Americanists kind of substantively, but methodologically, APSR didn't really change all that much.
Oh, yeah. In fact, it was more homogenous. So there are a couple other things I think that are worth mentioning before we break in this piece that I thought just were kind of interesting or amusing. So she clearly, if you were a sophisticated feminist IR scholar in the mid-90s, you were going to kill somebody if you heard the name Margaret Thatcher or Golda Meir one more time.
Yes.
Because there is a lot of, like, would you shut up about Thatcher and Meir right here. It's interesting that as late as 1997, you could still write about the field as believing that women were more peaceful, that this was a thing. And it was a standard stereotype of what feminist work was about. Sort of care ethic-y kinds of things. I also thought, I already mentioned that I thought the discussion of the state as a source of insecurity was really good. And it, of course, is another example of the way in which feminist scholarship aligns with other critical scholarship, post-colonial scholarship, or even non-critical scholarship that just pays attention to things like ethnic minorities and religious minorities. And the way that sits uncomfortably in IR theory, right? Because we're very attentive now to civil wars, politics of oppression, and yet when we scale up to the state level in mainstream IR, that stuff sort of drops out in interesting ways. The other things that I thought were worth mentioning.
Before you do, just one quick point underscoring your thing about Meir and Thatcher. Fukuyama's Women in the Evolution of World Politics piece is published in Foreign Affairs in 1998. So it is clearly the case that people can still write broadly at that time about women being peaceful and that being the primary contribution of feminism. And that same argument about Margaret Thatcher. That was the Iron Lady.
Golda. Mm-hmm. Right.
You know, these are the standard things.
But I will say that there is actually, I mean, as I understand it, because we've produced some students doing very good feminist but positivist work in the last few years. You know, so Maddie Schramm and Alex Stark have a really nice piece in Security Studies where they argue that, this is the kind of stuff I love, it's like Butler plus stats. but their argument is that women leaders are actually less likely to initiate conflicts conditioned upon the feminization of politics. So, you know, essentially that women who are in environments where they need to demonstrate leadership capacity in masculinized contexts are more aggressive. They overcompensate. Mm-hmm. But if you make women, high status women in politics more normal, right, the need to demonstrate that you have balls of steel disappears. So I don't think it's entirely wrong. It may be true that female leaders overall are less conflict prone than male leaders. But the point is that's not feminist. Right. That's not what feminist theory is about. That observation is a little part of the whole broad gamut of studying gender in IR from a feminist or a non-feminist standpoint.
Exactly. So. Exactly.
Yes, Kibbeth, can I help you? I stopped petting her.
Got to pet the cat.
Structural, so obviously where some of this is headed, and she says explicitly on 626, is the idea of structural violence.
Yeah.
You know, I think this is one of those concepts that, again, when we talk about, like, discourses of diversity and discourses of understanding versus actual practice, I mean, I think we would, you know, you can't throw a stone among academics and not hit somebody. You can't throw a stone and, like, there will be somebody. I mean, you cannot throw a stone without hitting somebody, because everybody would kind of agree, 95% of the field, and the 5% who wouldn't agree won't talk about it because they're worried about being ostracized, would say, of course, there's structural violence, right? But even now in 2020, that is not taken seriously within the theories often. You know, we had the piece, I don't remember, at ISQ. I don't know whether you were associate editing at that point, about kind of liberal pacification as being a form of violence. For like 12 authors, and it was a very kind of, it was sort of running this argument across a whole set of domains, but the idea was that there's a tremendous amount of violence and force that upholds the liberal peace.
Wasn't that that experimental piece that was written by that group, like, over the course of a day?
It might have been. I have no idea what its sociogenesis is. We certainly made them do a lot of revisions.
But yeah, it was part of, if I remember right, it was part of a project of a group of scholars that said, let's get together and actually spend the day at a workshop, not just talking about stuff, but let's write an article. And it was about liberal pacification.
Yeah. So that probably is the same thing.
It's a good piece.
Because it was, you know, really insightful, but sort of needed a lot of...
Hey.
I don't know if we've mentioned this on the podcast. One of the things that I both did that I'm proud of, but also pissed a lot of people off, and I think they're pissed off at their pissed off status might be justified, was, and this gets back to power relation, was that I was very insistent that things be written in a voice in a way that was accessible to the mainstream. Right. And in a sense, that was an imposition of structural violence. On the other sense, my view, I think, may be consistent with what Anne's doing here, was that we're not going to give you an excuse to say that you didn't understand the argument.
Oh, no.
That can't be your basis for saying that this is not acceptable.
Well, and maybe for you as well, but certainly for me, that my editorial insistence on that, both when I've been a journal editor and with the book series, is a reaction to the kind of Bob Gilpin writing about Richard Ashley thing that was in the 86 Neorealism and Its Critics book, in which Gilpin is basically saying, well, I didn't understand the argument, so gosh, it can't have meant much. No, I have always insisted that the bottom line be, no, you need to understand, you can disagree with the argument, but like, you need to write the argument in such a way that people who haven't spent years crawling through all of the linguistic nuances of this particular continental theorist, like, you can't just write that. You have to write it in a way that the argument is comprehensible more broadly. So, no, I've insisted the same thing for exactly that reason. So,
I mean, essentially it's saying you have to understand that incommensurability is going to be used against you strategically. You can either say, if you are more marginal to the audience you're speaking to, you're going to say, you can give them the middle finger and say, well, that's fine, we don't care. Mm-hmm. Or you can not give them the excuse of not understanding their argument for not engaging.
Exactly.
So then this is certainly a piece that I think, I don't know, again, it's hard from our perspective. You know, I find Alex Wendt's work extremely accessible, but I know there are people who don't. But this is, I think, an extremely accessible piece. Mm-hmm. I would be very disappointed if somebody walked away from this and saying they didn't understand it.
Right. No, exactly.
And it's written a very engaging, accessible tone. So I think it's a successful piece, ultimately.
I agree.
Is that your...
No, I agree. I think that it is not what I would assign for Feminism 101, because I think even Feminist IR is in a different place than it was when Tickner was summarizing these sorts of contributions. But certainly for PhD students trying to understand the place of feminist thought and feminist scholarship in the field, I've assigned not just this piece, but the Cohen piece that it's responding to, Cohen's own response to this piece.
And the correct one,
the
actual one.
Though I often assign the two institutions as well, just to get a snapshot of that. But the Cohen Millennium piece, this, there's a second round. There's a response that Cohen writes to this, a response that Tickner writes to that response.
Why don't you tell us about that briefly?
No, it the debate does not generate consensus.
Doesn't advance. It remains stuck.
Cohen reiterates his position and kind of doubles down on what will become the KKV position.
A position that he would no longer do. I mean, it's
fascinating. But at the time, that was the position. And that kind of stopped the debate. But showing that, I find that's useful, especially for PhD students, to get a sense of what these kinds of troubled engagements look like. And then, actually, the thing I would also recommend that people look at is Laura Schoberg, who was a student of Ann Tickner's and Hayward Alker's. But Laura Schoberg's introduction to the special issue of, I believe, Security Studies that she put together.
That would be Security Studies. I think that was the one that Lauren had a piece
in. Yes, and that was the piece that they set up a workshop in particular to have feminist and traditional mainstream security scholars at the same workshop talking about pieces. Very strategic.
They essentially threw down the gauntlet of Security Studies and said, you know, okay, you want to, you know, you're serious about this?
Yep. So that becomes the consequence of the sort of strategy that Tickner is envisioning here. We're going to have engagement. So not surprisingly, we have a Tickner student who is then engaging in precisely that way and saying, all right, we're going to take this seriously. We're going to do it. We're going to put together a whole special issue. We're going to have feminist scholars and non-feminist scholars talking about issues. We're going to engage in ways that are going to open up the space. And troubled engagement is probably a good way to describe the whole thing, because it's not as if everybody walked into that and then was somehow convinced and went off in a totally different direction. But it's a very productive engagement. It's a very engaging special issue with a lot of really, really trenchant pieces that open up a whole series of avenues for research on security in a much broader way. And that's the kind of thing that issues from precisely this strategy of engagement that Tickner's calling for in this piece. So when I have assigned this, when I have written this up as stuff in a syllabus for PhD students, it's been that whole sequence. As just, here's where you have to see where, sort of where this goes.
So one last point about this, though. I worry that when we say things like, well, I wouldn't, you know, this is not what I would assign for Feminism 101, that we might be assuming too much. I mean, in a sense, we might be, this, I talk about prospective, retrospective, how we read this, you know, at the age of 47, 48, right, versus how we might read this at the age of 22, 23. I'm not sure that's, I mean, obviously you've done it and you're a successful educator, so I don't want to cast aspersions, but I actually think that this might be a piece that should be assigned, because I think you cannot assume, I think this is written for people who don't know much, even though it's also written for people who know a lot, right? It has that polyvalent characteristic. And I think this would actually be very useful for people who had no exposure to this kind of theory, who might be still knee-jerk I got into IR so I could study security dilemmas. There's nothing wrong with studying security dilemmas, it's an important topic, but have a more limited conception of the field. Or think about feminist theory as this mysterious other, which is all about, like, you know, disempowering men or something. I don't know. I mean, I don't have it.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
I wonder, because it is so accessible, and because while it's not on the cutting edge of feminist theory, it's not trying to be. I mean, this is not cutting edge for Anne at the time.
No.
It's more, it gives you some basic perspectives, and it does so in a way which is inclusive rather than, so when Anne is defining feminism, she's not defining it in a way that excludes certain kinds of feminisms, which is too often the problem when you try to pin down something like that.
Right.
She's defining it in a way which is both kind of accessible to a more, a more linguistic term feminism versus a more materialist feminism versus a more, I don't know, light culturalist feminism. So I actually see real, and it's short. I mean, yeah. It's not a long piece.
Yeah. The piece I like of hers for that, actually, is her introduction to her volume of essays from a few years later, the Feminist Voyages book. She does a really nice job kind of canvassing a number of different kinds of feminism in that piece. So, I don't know, I'll have to think about that in terms of this piece and the role that it might serve, say, for more of a, more of an undergraduate audience.
You'd have to assign this fairly late in the sequence, which raises issues about the week on feminism. But nonetheless, right. I think, because you have to have a fair amount of contextual knowledge about IR to make sense of this, is the problem.
That would be my concern about it. So, yeah.
But on the feminism side, it's very accessible.
True. No, it's very, it definitely is. Something to think about. Ann Tickner has written a number of pieces over the years that have great pedagogical value for different levels.
So I would imagine for an intro PhD course, this would be extraordinarily useful.
Yes, and that has been my experience, that it works really well with PhDs. So, because it also allows, it allows a discussion of kind of what the field was like at that point, and so you can do a little bit of that. And of course, for me assigning it, it's even better because then I can ask Anne to pop downstairs and pop into the room.
In
the before time.
In the after time, it's just more likely she'll say yes when you ask her to zoom in.
Exactly. But
okay.
We do what we can to survive. I think that's good. I think we've covered what we want to cover.
I had this Sik Su moment here of thinking about I don't have penis envy, I just want to play with one once in a while kind of thing. I think that was Sik Su. Now I'm going to embarrass myself. I haven't read this stuff in 30 years. You are turning bright red. So, but nonetheless, she's now mapping, wow, that green screen effect is really wacky. I get this green spot in my eye, and when I'm really close, it's like my eyes turn into books.
Yes.
Do you see that? Isn't that crazy?
I see. That's awesome.
Ooh. Now it's a book. Now it's an eye. Now it's an eye. Oh, he's very senior.
Senior stuff. Because again, we want to make sure that we're not picking on a contemporary.
Yeah, at some point, though, we're going to have to start reading more interesting stuff that's contemporary.
Yeah.
And we'll just, I think we've just basically been. I don't think anything we've done. I can't imagine anything we've said about anybody being inappropriate with a junior faculty member because we always are essentially positive about what we read.
Right. We couldn't pick somebody who's junior in our own department. So.
No, I think is there somebody you want to character assassinate? So I think that's what we should do. Somebody whose work you want to just really.